Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson. It's officially week two of the general election campaign and we're kicking things off with a spending row. James, last week we had both Sajid Javid and John McDonnell lay out their spending plans, both of which involved extra borrowing. But over the weekend, the Tories released a dossier in which they claimed that Labour's plans would cost a cool $1.2 trillion in the first 5 years of a Labour government. Now, this was quickly criticised by Labour as fake news on the grounds that ultimately what the Tories have done here is taken everything from the 2017 manifesto, added in commitments since then, and also looked at what was voted on at Labour conference, which doesn't necessarily become policy, and therefore people shouldn't trust the figure. Do you think the Tories are coming out of this well?
I think it's effective. There's a reason why they put this out before the Labour manifesto has come out, because the Labour manifesto will slim down some of these commitments. But their aim is to get this £1.2 trillion figure into people's heads. I think the Tories feel they're playing a bit of catch-up in that they worry that last week's spending announcements, you know, that it came across as Labour and the Tories were basically planning to do roughly the same kind of thing. Labour were going to spend a little more. Well, actually, Labour are planning to spend massively more than the Tories. And I think this £1.2 trillion is an attempt to get back on the front foot on that. I also think that some of the arguments, and this is also worth remembering, that you know, there was going to be civil service costings of Labour's proposed policies, but then their massive row kicked off about that, with Labour objecting to the use of civil service resources, what they saw as a kind of partisan attack. So those numbers never came out. So these are the Tories' own calculations. And you are undoubtedly right that when the manifesto comes out, that number is going to not be as large as $1.2 trillion. But the Tories are trying to find a way to drive home just how much Labour are planning to spend.
Fraser, is it driving home the message for you?
I'm afraid not. When I saw the figure, I almost burst out laughing. I mean, 1.2 trillion. It makes you think, is there even such a word as trillion? And this is the old tactic of not just double counting, but quintuple counting. This is over like 5 years. And I don't know why politicians fall into this trap. They reckon that to make a figure sound bigger than possible, you basically use little statistical tricks. So you will exaggerate this assumption, that assumption, and then you add it all on top of each other. And what's the maximum number you can get? And the problem is that by the time you get to the word trillion, which most normal people will not have no idea how many zeros come after the word trillion, it just fails a plausibility test. I mean, during the referendum, George Osborne did pretty much the same thing. He tried to stretch definitions, stretch the rules of English language, and claim that Brexit would leave you £4,300 a year worse off. That was the great figure that they all stood behind. And that was, I think polls showed, that almost nobody believed that figure. Quite right, too, because first off, it was concocted. And secondly, most people's income is not the sort of level where it could plausibly go down by 4,300. I mean, a lot of people are only got like £8,000 a year of disposable income. The idea it would be halved by the Brexit vote was a joke. I ended up actually thinking about the late Terry Wogan. Now, here, the last time I heard the word trillion used in politics was after Gordon Brown's G7 summit. I think it was 2009. And he wanted to make out lie, basically, that he had come up with a massive big rescue package. So he decided to get his old statistical alchemists to work and work at how much money people had committed already. If you can multiply this by this, expand it over why many years. And he came out with a figure of $1 trillion. Don't worry, he said, we've agreed a historic $1 trillion bailout fund of us G20 countries. And sure, a few newspaper headlines, they went for the trillion thing because it's a great word to put in a headline. But Terry Wogan the next day, I think, of the best analysis of all, he just kept laughing and laughing at this. $1 trillion, he was saying. $1 trillion, we're supposed to be bankrupt. But look, these guys have found $1 trillion under the sofa. And that is the problem if you come up with figures that are so big. They simply sound laughable.
And James, do you think as a result of that, people might actually, in a way, it might backfire to the point that if it feels as though it's fake news, actually the message doesn't land in terms of spending, and then it makes it harder for the Conservatives to actually legitimately explain why Sajid Javid borrowing an extra $22 billion a year is different to John McDonnell borrowing an extra $55 billion a year?
Personally, think as I was doing the washing up last night, if you listen to the radio news, this was kind of perfectly how the Tories would have wanted to land. That £1.2 trillion figure was there. And I think that, you know, and then and there was a kind of discussion based around that. I also think that there's a question in politics, which is, does what you are claiming chime with what voters worry about? And I think voters do worry about just how much money Corbyn is planning to spend. And I mean, as we discussed on Saturday's podcast, it is a lot more. Now, you are clearly right that we would have a better level of political debate in this country if, for example, the Office of Budget Responsibility costed the manifestos.
Something the Lib Dems are today calling for them to.
Yeah, no, that would be a very sensible move for you. Cost the manifesto of all the parties, and then you can have a kind of baseline discussion. I think considering... I don't mean this dossier strikes me as anything out of the ordinary in the way that political parties do politics in election campaigns in terms of what they say about cuts or what they say about the money that they would spend would lead to.
Now, elsewhere, the other thing that could have a big impact on how the Tories fare in a general election could be how many seats the Brexit Party fields candidates in. There's some talk that Nigel Farage could be about to perform a U-turn, perhaps it's a graceful pivot, on the number of candidates his party will stand. We're expecting an announcement later today. Fraser, over the weekend, Nigel Farage withdrew from a media appearance, which he isn't usually likely to do. Do you think we could be about to see the Brexit Party changing tack because they are coming under a lot of pressure from some Brexit Party candidates, Leave voters and Tory politicians who are saying if they do what they currently plan to, which is stand seats in most areas, they could stop Brexit?
Yes, I think it does look like he's moving in that direction. We had a piece in the magazine this week by Lionel Shriver, who makes the point, probably better than anybody has made it, that wouldn't it be ironic if the guy who'd been campaigning for Brexit all his life, most of his adult life, would eventually scupper that Brexit because of a vainglorious refusal to stand down when it was quite clear that only one of Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson is likely to deliver a Brexit. I also think that he's been struck by the lack of his support as well. You've got a few loyal, hardcore Farageistas who say, stick on there, Nigel, keep going. What Boris Johnson's offering isn't really Brexit. But you've got every member of the supposedly hardline Spartan Tory ERG group who've gone along with Boris Johnson's deal. I don't think they did that to be pliable or amenable. They're not pliable or amenable types. You've got other Brexit Party candidates who've been standing down. And I know some Brexit Party candidates who haven't distanced themselves from Farage, but will say in private, yes, this is the wrong thing. I don't want to do the dirty on him because he was instrumental in setting up this party. But I think it is wrong that if we were to stand in a way that's likely to weaken the Conservative vote and make Brexit less likely. Difficult for Farage to do because he's set up this massive apparatus now. He's got fundraisers, he's even got sort of Brexit Party TV channel. And if not this, then what awaits him? He's back to the LBC studios, a rather ignominious sort of future on the lecture circuit. But I think he ought to take solace in the fact that he basically saved Brexit twice. He put it on the menu and got Cameron to give a referendum. And when Theresa May was about to back down, it was pressure from Farage and his incredible entrepreneurial streak in creating the Brexit Party from almost nothing that forced the Conservative Party to take Boris Johnson and reaffirm their Brexit commitment as a means of getting rid of Farage. So many people spend their whole lives in politics and do not achieve a single thing. Farage has never managed to get into Parliament and yet has shaped the country's politics in a way that few other cabinet members could dream of doing. So if I were him, I would take this as a win.
James, speaking to Conservative MPs over the weekend, some in heavy leave areas, I was very struck by the fact they're all very pleasantly surprised that the 31st of October deadline isn't coming up too much. And actually, when it comes to the Brexit Party, criticism of the deal aren't really coming up. The one area where they say they do sometimes get flack is online, when I think it's probably easier to get a certain group of dedicated activists. But they don't feel like there is this Brexit Party push there used to be. So how big a threat is the Brexit Party to the Tories if they don't do as some hope and stand down candidates?
Well, I think you're totally right. Today is the 11th of November, and there is no sign of an October the 31st backlash developing in the polls. I also think that motive matters in politics. And when Nigel Farage accuses Boris Johnson of having a Remainers Brexit, it just doesn't ring true in the way that... It just doesn't seem plausible in the way that when he made that charge at Theresa May and Philip Hammond, people are like, oh yeah, they didn't want to leave in the first place. Boris Johnson kind of, you know, obviously led the campaign to leave. So the idea that this is, you know, a secret ploy to keep us essentially, you know, as in as you can, just doesn't wash. I think the reason that the Tories still worry is... Although at the moment the polls suggest the Tories are on course for a majority, they're on course for a majority by winning lots of seats by slim margins. And all it would take is just a little uptick in support for the Brexit Party, for the Tories not to win those seats, and for Labour to be able to hold on in a lot of those seats in what you dubbed the kind of the red wall of Labour's holdouts in the Midlands and North Wales. And so I think that is one of the reasons why the Tories are nervous. I think there's a... I personally find it hard to imagine that Farage is going to be prepared to give up the chance of, you know, two prime-time election programmes, which is what he'd have to give up if he stood down a very large number of candidates. But I also think it's quite clear that the Brexit Party are not going to become the force in this election, that they might still play a massive role in terms of influencing the result, but they're not going to become a force in this election in terms of winning seats and a huge vote share that some people thought might well have been the case just a few months ago.
And finally, to mark Remembrance Sunday, or to coincide with it at least, you saw several of the main parties pushing new policies regarding veterans' rights, and we're also seeing a move to defence as an issue. James, what are the main offers? And we've also had Emily Thornberry out on the broadcast round to make some of these points.
So both Labour and the Tories are proposing policies designed to essentially kind of help veterans with the transition back into civilian life. Tories are kind of offering kind of guaranteed interviews for public sector jobs. They are also offering a kind of veterans discount card, although I think some people pointed out the kind of veterans card that the Tories have previously promised has yet to materialise. I think most controversially, they're suggesting amending the Human Rights Act, so essentially mean but it couldn't be used for repeat investigations of soldiers involved in incidents in the Troubles in Northern Ireland, for example. Although I think we should tread with caution about these changes to the law. In that, while as witch hunts are not a good idea, we should be unashamed about the fact that we should hold our own armed forces operating in our own country to a higher standard than we would hold a kind of terrorist organisation. Labour, for their part, I think, you know, Emily Thornberry was out doing the media this morning, and I think that you see here this is a problem for Labour, which is Jeremy Corbyn made a lot of mileage in the 2017 election about having been against the Iraq war. That was a kind of call that was seen as being having been vindicated by history. I think what the Emily Thornberry interview shows is he basically hasn't met a kind of UK intervention that he likes. And, you know, I think that does begin to reveal there is a kind of anti-Western element to his foreign policy. I also think that, you know, again, in a way that didn't happen in 2017 because the idea didn't seem plausible, on GMB this morning, Emily Thornberry got pushed on kind of Jeremy Corbyn and nuclear weapons. And, you know, there is obviously an issue which I don't think you're ever going to see Jeremy Corbyn say that he believes in nuclear weapons. And yet, you know, Labour's position is to maintain Trident. It seems rather odd to maintain a deterrent if you're going to advertise that you would never use the deterrent.
Fraser, do you think that defence could be the undoing of Labour at this election, or do you think actually perhaps the country's more in step than sometimes we presume?
I think that defence is powerful insofar as it's a proxy of Jeremy Corbyn's patriotism and his love of this country. Remember that the charge that Ian Austin laid against him was that decent, patriotic Labour voters should vote for Boris Johnson because Jeremy Corbyn does not love his country. That was basically the patriotic charge that Ian Austin and many Labour Party members believe that the core Labour vote, the people who the Tories are trying to woo this time around, their sense of patriotism will prevent them voting for Corbyn. And this is the in, the Tories' great in, saying, look, if you do love your country, then, and Tony Benn, by the way, loved his country, Michael Foot loved his country, Jeremy Corbyn doesn't. This isn't your normal lefty, this is somebody who has sided with Britain's enemies, from everyone from Vladimir Putin down to Hezbollah and Hamas. So I think that defence will be a proxy for this. This is the tool that the Tories will keep trying to use to climb up what you were the first to call, Katie, the red wall.
A pollster term, the first to print. Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James.